Hot damn. Vietnam. Vietnam, that little old country which had been under his nose all these years. Things were getting too quiet in Vietnam. If there was one thing hotter than Harlem in the summer, it was air raids on rice patties and napalm on red gooks. Now we had a game when the war got too good and everybody was given too much space to that. He could always tell the niggers it was good time to be marching on the White House. When they got a little too serious, he could bring back Vietnam. He could even make all those Barry Goldwater rednecks and state troopers happy. That was a happy nation when everybody had something going for them. The niggers had their civil rights and the rednecks could be killing gooks. Yes, thought the president, his friends and associates were correct in their estimate of him as a genius. Hot damn, Vietnam. I believe our present situation in Vietnam is so irrational that any attempt to deal with it logically is illogical in the way surrealism is illogical, and rational political discussion of Adolf Hitler's motives was illogical and then obscene. Bombing a country at the same time you are offering it aid is as morally repulsive as beating up a kid in an alley and stopping to ask for a kiss. Reading the papers these days is a nightmare of unrequited love. If one's country lives like a woman in some part of the unconscious dream life of each of us, if beneath all our criticisms and detestations of America's vulgarity, misuse of power, and sheer pompous stupidity, there has been still some optimistic love affair with the secret potentialities of this nation, some buried, unvoiced faith that the nature of America was finally good and not evil, well, that faith has taken a pistol whipping in the last months. The romance seems not even tragic or doomed, but dirty and misplaced. Still, let me assume there is some point in trying to be reasonable about Vietnam, even if it is only to discover that there is no logic in the situation. But let me at least make one straightforward attempt to understand what transpires there. I will, however, insist that the logic we employ runs close to the vein of theological argument, for we must try to speak rationally about a mystery. Will it make sense if we say Lyndon Johnson is alienated? Alienated from what, you may ask? But one must speak first of alienation, that intellectual category which would take you from many a turn of the mind in its attempt to explain that particular corrosive sensation so many of us feel in the chest and the gut so much of the time, that sense of the body growing empty within, of the psyche pierced by a wound whose dimensions keep opening, that unendurable conviction that one is hollow, displaced, without a single identity at one's center. I quote Eric Josephson. Alienation has been used to refer to an extraordinary variety of psychosocial disorders, including loss of self, anxiety states, anomie, despair, depersonalization, rootlessness, apathy, social disorganization, loneliness, atomization, powerlessness, meaninglessness, isolation, pessimism, and the loss of belief or values. Among the groups described as alienated are women, industrial workers, white-collar workers, migrant workers, artists, suicides, mentally disturbed, addicts, the aged, the young generation as a whole, juvenile delinquents in particular, voters, non-voters, consumers, audiences of mass media, sex deviants, victims of prejudice and discrimination, the prejudiced, bureaucrats, political radicals, the physically handicapped, immigrants, exiles, vagabonds, and recluses. What a comprehensive list. Is anything to be gained by adding to it the name of Lyndon Johnson? You may still ask, what is he alienated from? The Asian peasant? The dishwasher at the Istanbul Hilton? Of course not. You cannot be alienated unless you wish to participate. Lyndon Johnson does not wish to share a bowl of rice with an Asian peasant. How then is he alienated, and from what? And I say to you, in no disrespect and much uneasiness, that it is possible he is alienated from his own clear sanity, that his mind has become a consortium of monstrous disproportions, of pictures of himself in duplicate, 40 feet high, 80 feet high. Lyndon Johnson is not alienated from power. He is the most powerful man in the United States. But he is alienated from judgment. He is close to an imbalance which at worst could tip the world from orbit. America is a country which has never decided what its nature is. It's a country in which every citizen is perpetually confronting the fact that he does not know if he's a member of a good country or a bad country, a noble country or a mean country. And so for that reason, the psychology of a member of a minority group sits upon every American, I believe. Now, this state, which, as I say, demands action, is a demand which should either kill a brave man or force him to grow. But when a coward is put in need of such action, a coward tears the wings off flies. The great fear that lies upon America is not that Lyndon Johnson is privately close to insanity, so much as that he is the expression of the near insanity of most of us. And his need for action is America's need for action. Not brave action, but action. Any kind of action. Any move to get the motors going. A future death of the spirit lies close and heavy upon American life. A cancerous emptiness at the center, which calls for a circus. The country is in disease. It has been in disease for a long time. There's been nothing in our growth which was organic. We never solved our depression. We merely went to war back in 1941, and going to war never won it. Not in our own minds, not as men. We won it, but as sources of supply. We still do not know that we are equal to the Russians. We won a war, but we did not really win it. Not in the secret of our sleep. So we have not really had a prosperity. We've had fever. We've grown rich because of one fact with two opposite interpretations. The fact is that there's been a Cold War. There's been a Cold War which came either because communism was indeed a real threat to our freedom, or it was a Cold War which came because capitalism could not survive without an economy geared to war. Or is it both reasons? Who can know? Who can really know? The center of our motive is an enigma. Is this country extraordinary or accursed? And when we think of communism, we have to wonder if we are accursed, for we have not even found our communist threat. We have had a secret police organization and an invisible government large enough by now to occupy the moon. We have hunted communists from the top of the Time Life building to the bottom of the Collier Mine. We have not found that many, not that many. And we have looked like Keystone Cops. Our country was fearful, half mad, inauthentic. It needed a purge or it needed a war. Bile was stirring in the pits of the national conscience, and little to oppose it but a lard of guilt cold as the most mediocre of our needs. We took formal public steps toward a great society, that great society of computers and pills, of job aptitudes and bad architecture, of psychoanalysis, superhighways, astronauts, vaccinations, and a Peace Corps, that great society where nothing but frozen corn would be sold in the smallest towns of Iowa, where censorship would disappear, but every image would be manipulated from birth to death. Something in the buried animal of modern life grew bestial at the thought of this great society. The most advanced technological nation of the civilized world was the one now closest to blood, to shedding the blood and burning the flesh of Asian peasants it had never seen. The Pentagon had been kept on a leash for close to 20 years. Presidents so mediocre in their talents as Truman and Eisenhower had kept the military from dominating the nation, but Johnson did not. Now, I have one set of remarks more to make. They concern practical suggestions. I've been visionary in my demands, for it is visionary in 1965 to ask of America that it return to isolationism. No, this country wishes to have an empire. The grimmest truth may be that half of America, at least, must be not unwilling to have a war in Vietnam. Otherwise, Lyndon Johnson could not have made his move, since Lyndon Johnson never in his life has dreamed of moving against a majority. Let us then insist on this. It is equally visionary, but it is at least visionary in a military way, and we are talking to militarists. Let us say that if we are going to have a war with the Viet Cong, let it be a war of foot soldier against foot soldier. If we wish to take a strange country away from strangers, let us at least be strong enough and brave enough to defeat them on the ground. Our Marines, some would say, are the best soldiers in the world. The counter-argument is that native guerrillas can defeat any force of a major power, man to man. Let us then fight on fair grounds. Let us say to Lyndon Johnson, to monstrous McNamara, and to the generals on the scene, fight like men. Go in man to man against the Viet Cong. Call off the Air Force. They prove nothing except that America is coterminous with the Mafia. Let us win man to man, or lose man to man, but let us stop pulverizing people whose faces we have never seen. But of course, we will not stop, nor will we ever fight man to man against poor peasants. Their vision of existence might be more ferocious and more determined than our own. No, we would rather go on as the most advanced monsters of civilization, pulverizing instinct with our detonations, our State Department experts in their little bow ties, and our bombs. Only, listen, Lyndon Johnson, you have gone too far this time. You are a bully with an Air Force. And since you will not call off your Air Force, there are young people who will persecute you back. It is a little thing, but it will hound you into nightmares and endless corridors of night without sleep. It will hound you. For listen, this is only one of the thousand things they will do. They will go on marches, and they will make demonstrations, and they will begin a war of public protest against you, which will never cease. It will go on, and it will get stronger and stronger. But listen to just one of the thousand things they can do. Just listen to this little thing, which is one. These young people are, I think, going to print up little pictures of you, Lyndon Johnson, the size of postcards, size of stamps. And some of them will glue these pictures to walls and posters and telephone booths and billboards. I don't advise it. I would tell these students not to do it to you, but they will. They will find places to put these pictures. They will want to paste your picture, Lyndon Johnson, on a postcard and send it to you. Some will send it to your advisors. Some will send these pictures to men and women at other schools. These pictures will be sent everywhere. These pictures will be pasted up everywhere, upside down. Silently, without a word, Lyndon Johnson, that photograph of you is going to start appearing everywhere. Your head will speak out, even to the peasant in Asia. He will say that not all Americans are unaware of your monstrous vanity, overweening piety, and doubtful motive. It will tell them that we trust our president so little and think so little of him that we send his picture everywhere, upside down. Vietnam, hot damn. You, Lyndon Johnson, will see those pictures up everywhere, upside down, 4 inches high and 40 feet high. You, Lyndon Baines Johnson, are going to be coming up for air everywhere, upside down. Everywhere, upside down, upside down.